Good evening. How lovely to see all of you here, old friends and medium known friends and completely new friends. So I'm just curious, is anybody here for the first time tonight? Yeah, many of you. Welcome, welcome, welcome. So good to have you here. And welcome back. My name's Kathy, for those who don't know me. And I'd like to talk this evening about a particular moment. I'll tell you a few stories about this moment before I tell you what the moment is. And I'm reflecting a lot these days on the last 30 years of my professional path because I'm retiring. This morning I had my final planning meeting with a man who works in the Pajaro Valley School District. I've worked with him for about 15 years. And tomorrow morning is the last meeting I will attend of a group that I have been facilitating since 1991. So it's very much on my mind. It's not just my a career as a consultant and facilitator, but also before that I was a classroom teacher. I taught kindergarten, third grade, and fourth grade, also in Watsonville. So some of my stories come from those years, as well as just from my own experience, making my way through life. And each of these little stories is a story about this moment. So one, the first moment, when I was a third grade teacher, there was a young man in my class who every day came to school with the most sullen look on his face. He never smiled. He came in and he sat down and he didn't make eye contact with many people and he did really poorly in his schoolwork and he tended to get in trouble because the other kids didn't really like him and because he did things to them that bothered them. And so he was a loner. And I'll make up a name, I'll call him Carlos. Every morning when he came in, I would look him in the eye and I'd say, "Good morning, Carlos." And I did that for 2.5 months. And one morning, he looked up at me and we made eye contact and he smiled. And that moment changed everything. Because he knew and I knew. He knew and I knew. And he knew that I knew. So that's the first example of this moment. The second example I was thinking about was a group of teachers I worked with up in the East Bay. And they were a bunch of art and music teachers and drama teachers. And they had no funding for arts in their district for like 20 years, and all of a sudden the state was giving money so that they could decide how to spend this money to begin to resupply and refund their art and music and theater arts programs. So they had started out, and they were going to meet for about 4 months, every couple times a month, this big task force. School districts like to have task forces. So, and they like to have somebody help them, and that was me. So they started off with a bang. They had grand visions. They had a lot of ideas about how they were going to go forward and make these decisions and make this plan. And after the first meeting, there was this strike, very, very acrimonious strike. And the management and the teachers were just like, lots of animosity, lots of really bad blood, lots of distrust. So the second meeting that we had was right after the strike had ended, like just barely after the strike had ended. And I remember walking into that room and it was one of those times like, oh God, why do I do this? This is so hard. I could just feel so much suffering in the room. Oh, and the first meeting, one of the things that we had done as a warm-up activity was I had invited them to share anecdotes of students that they had known for whom art, music, and theater had made a difference in their lives. So we had started this task force with some real potent stories about, you know, kids who found their voice, who found their peace, who found healing and empowerment through art and music and theater arts. And we had all cried together and all that. So anyhow, here we are, second meeting, totally like this tension in the room. You know, the administrator in charge got up and started opening the meeting, and right away some of the teachers started sniping at her. And she and I had talked, and I had said, look, if the energy's off, can I just wing it and kind of follow my intuition? And we wouldn't follow the stated agenda. She said, okay, fine. Well, she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I said, let's not do what we were going to do. And well, before the moment, I had a moment, and that moment was, what the heck am I going to do now? And, you know, I mean, there were different options. And we have a statement in Zen. We have a story called Jumping Off the 100-Foot Pole. Kind of get the analogy. Maybe you don't, but, you know, imagine. You know, it's basically, you know, there's no guarantees. You don't know what's going to happen. It's a big risk. But you got to do something. You're up there, and so you just boldly, you know, stick out your foot like what? Like, who is it in the cartoons who do that? Was it the Roadrunner or the Coyote? I don't remember. But you know, you just kind of like stick out your foot into the empty space, and you just go, right? So I just decided I was going to jump off the 100-foot pole, and I commented to them. I said something like, you know, I feel and understand, you know, the difficulties that you've been through since the last time I saw you. And I feel it in the room. And I'm just curious. I'm remembering the last time I saw you, you told me some stories. And I started telling back to them some of the stories that they had told me. And I tried to recreate it as best I could. And I said, I'm wondering, has anything like that happened in your classroom since I last saw you? And then this is why it's the 100-foot pole, because it could have totally flopped. You know, they could have just been, continued to be mad and wanted to fight and got mad at me. But a couple of the teachers, you know, just said, well, actually, yeah. I said, please share. And they started to connect with this experience that they had of basically why they do what they do. And after a few of them had shared, it was like this was the moment then. They kind of just looked around at each other, and one of the teachers in the room said, hey, let's get back to work. I said, okay. And they rolled up their sleeves and went back to work and decided how to allocate resources to fund arts education in their district for the first time in 20 years. And here's the third and last example of the moment. And this is a moment that I wrote about in this book that is called Zen Teachings in Challenging Times. And it's at the end of the essay that I wrote. The essay was basically about how several different practitioners worked their way through their emotional anguish after the last presidential election. And my apologies if anybody here, you know, was happy after that election, which I know some people were. That's okay. And I wasn't, and the people in this article weren't. So that's what I wrote about. That's my experience. And anyhow, I'm not going to read you much, but what I want to read you is the moment, because that's what I'm talking about here. So I wrote about how it was really hard for me, and I'd been supporting other people, and now I had to deal with my own feelings, and I went out to the woods, and that's what I do. And I talked to the trees and cried and all those things. And then I talked to Patrick, and he calmed me down, talked me off the ledge yet again. And so then this is second to the last paragraph in the essay. And, you know, the next morning, Jean asked, how are you feeling? And I said, in all honesty, you know, I feel like my energy is shifting. Nothing had changed in the external world to make me feel safe or positive. that it was like the way the wind shifts and disperses the clouds, or how a storm rains itself out and the air becomes electric and clear. Even as I felt the poignancy of my personal despair, I also felt connected to my near companions, as well as all of those strategizing and taking action in the public arena. I felt all of these currents of life as it is flowing through me simultaneously. The human dimension with our troubling events and agitating news, as well as the rocks, trees, ocean, and sky. The one bright pearl. The crows eating the last persimmon off the tree in our backyard. So what is this moment that I speak of? I could give you many more examples, but I won't. I've thought about what is this moment because I know it when I feel it. There would always be, not always, but most often, at some point, it's the moment when you awaken to a sense of possibility. And it doesn't mean that your problem is solved. It doesn't mean you're still not going to have difficult times ahead. But it's a moment where I call it, I've been writing a lot, so I'm also sharing from some of my writing I've been doing. I've started to call it, it's like tapping into a wellspring. And what is that wellspring that you're tapping into? Well, I would offer to you that it's the wellspring of human potential. You know, my Carlos, he still had his difficult home life that he had to deal with. He still had a lot of academic, a lot of work to do in his academics. But he knew that he had a partner to support him in his effort. He knew that there was somebody who saw him as he was and accepted him as a worthy and as a capable human being. And that experience of somebody believing in you, I believe, is a transformational power of the power of human potential. And the same thing with the teachers. You know, they were mad. They'd had a really difficult political experience. The politics continued in that district to be just as funky and difficult the entire time I worked there. But there was a way that they were, at for whatever reason, that collection of people were willing to connect to something else, which was this opportunity to make a difference in their students having resources for art and music and theater education, which they all knew was life-saving. And there's a creative energy that gets unleashed that I experience when that's where we shift our attention to. And I actually think that that energy then is energy that we can bring forward to help resolve those tough problems. It's a real resource. We have the resources that we need on this planet to solve the tough problems. We have enough food to feed all the hungry people on this planet. We have the intelligence to deal, you know, with the climate issues and with our carbon problem. We have the intelligence. We have the resources, but we don't access it. We can't access it. It's blocked. It's obstructed. There are obstructions between us and this potential. So this is what I'm thinking about these days. This is what I'm interested in is, first of all, what are the obstructions? And second of all, is there some way to be liberated from them? And I think that's what the Buddha was suggesting we might consider when he pointed out things like, you know, all beings have the potential to awaken. Well, maybe that was the Mahayanists, but, you know, Buddha believed in human potential, or he wouldn't have taught for 40 years about the opportunity of liberating ourselves from suffering. You know, if there's no human potential, why bother doing any of this? So the obstructions. If you've been to my talks over the years, you know there's certain themes. And one of the themes is that whenever I want to talk about something like this, I always think about the four different, I'm starting to call them four different domains of human experience. And that's the mind and the heart and the spirit and the body. So I want to talk about obstructions and liberation in these areas as it applies to kind of actualizing our human potential to bring forward to help solve the tough problems of our world and also in ourselves. You know, some of us are called to try to save the world, and some of us it's enough sparingly, you know, all we can do to just try to save ourselves or somebody that's close to us, you know. And by save, of course, in Buddhism, we don't mean convert them to Buddhism. We mean help relieve their suffering, help them cross over the river so they can feel like little Carlos, like, oh, I'm a worthy person. I mean something. I have value. I have potential. I can learn. I can grow. Gee, maybe I think I will learn how to do that math problem. I can still see his face. It's like etched in my mind forever and in my heart. So Buddhism, I think, is great at studying the obstructions from in the mind. Buddhism is, like, I think, the best in that. That's what a lot of Buddhism is about, is what is the way that our own thinking gets in the way of our being able to actualize the fullness of our potential. You know, our potential for allowing our broader intelligence to come forth. What are the ways that our mind gets in the way of maximizing our full potential? I'd love to hear a few things that you have noticed. Yeah.
When you were talking, I kept thinking about how letting go, to me, was the way of that path of liberation, because I think the mind likes to create the barricades. Like, oh, I can't possibly do that. That's not possible. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, like, letting go, it means letting go of those ideas. And that's how I can kind of get liberated from those thoughts.
Letting go of those limiting thoughts, that voice that says, oh, I can't do this.
Is probably going, why are we doing this? This is so, it's not like comfortable. It's not like the most enjoyable thing you could probably go do. we're not like feeding ourselves or watching a good movie or even hanging out with friends and talking. We're just sitting here watching those thoughts going in and out and torturing us. Why would we sit here and do that? And it's like, we have the skills to deal with these challenging times, and I'm in so much pain all the time. It's not when I'm just sitting. It's just when I'm sitting, it's like all of it's there. But it's also, I'm learning a skill of letting go, of letting go of the ideas of all my limitations, all the things that, you know, really trap me.
Yeah. And here you are.
Yeah.
Here you are, not listening to the limiting voices, but sitting and breathing in community.
Yeah. Yeah. So it felt really special to bring, it's the first time I've ever brought someone in who's never experienced.
Thank
this,
you.
Like this full practice. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like meditation, I teach that, but like, yeah. this is like the full, you know,
yeah. So thank you for doing that, and thank you for coming, and now you've had a little taste of this. How about one other person? Is there another thing that you've noticed about what gets in the way for you in the dimension of the mind? What obstructive thought or habit pattern kind of keeps you from feeling like you're really able to open up to this broader, you know, potential of our intelligence? Do you have something back there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how it matches, but I just feel like iPhones.
Say more.
The iPhones, like, sometimes what I think contributes to my suffering is when I'm on an iPhone and I'm maybe not doing something and I feel sad. And it almost feels like it's not productive, but I almost feel like it is because, or I feel like it might be productive to try to use like Google to sympathize with what I'm feeling or something like that, or something along those lines, when that's really not the case. That's been a habit that I've actually been struggling with for a long time.
I struggle with that habit too. I think that's a really good example, and I actually think that is a huge obstruction in the realization of our human mental intelligence. It's a tool. It's a wonderful tool. It opens us up to information, and that's a great thing, and yet it also is a way that we limit our frame. For example, you know, I only let in the news of the people that I agree with. You know, and that's what we're all doing. That's what we're all doing. Well, maybe not everybody here, but it feels to me like that's a lot of what we're all doing. So it's a way that it can expand and open and connect us, but it's also a way that we can limit and try to control. And we can also get very obsessive about like only looking at the bad stuff, and then we're stressing out our adrenal glands, and we think that everybody in the world is this way, when there's millions of people in the world who are not doing the things that the people on the little screen are doing. There's millions of people who are doing amazing, powerful things on this planet. We'd never know about it because we don't obsessively check on them. A lot of them aren't even, it's not even coming through. So those are just maybe a few little tiny ways. And of course, in the Buddha Dharma, there's lots and lots and lots of people who've sat and thought for years, decades, centuries about studying these ways that we, our mind, are the beautiful, beautiful resource of the human mind can be a source of obstruction and limitation rather than actually a source of liberation. And so then on the, you know, kind of on the positive side, I think, you know, what's possible with the human mind when we can, move beyond these fixed constructs of these self-reinforcing views, and when we begin to open up to, you know, diversity, we often use it as a source of obstruction. But diversity is evolution. You know, that we evolve by interacting with that which is not us, by that which is different from us. That's how we learn. That's how we grow. That's how organisms evolve, is by contacting and being contacted by that which is different. So diversity can be a source of enrichment, you know, rather than a fuel for polarization. We start building new connections. That's what intelligence is the building of new connections in the mind and learning together. And then that can actually deepen into wisdom. There you go. Working that. So that's the mind, okay? But this is the thing, and I always feel like it's so important to say this, because that's just one of the human experiential dimensions. And there's, I believe there's at least three others. See, I think, now I'll talk about the spirit, I think that the art and theater arts teachers, to me, it was not so much a mental obstruction, but it was what I would call a spiritual obstruction. They were cut off from their spirit. When I think about things like discouragement, and when we're just like, when we want to give up, and when we just feel drained and sapped, I don't think that's so much necessarily about how we're thinking. I think it's more that we're somehow blocked from energy. And what is it then that can awaken us to energy? Well, I think that again, in Buddhism, the aspirational, think of the bodhisattva, right? The bodhisattva is the being, our beings. This is, they're imaginary, but they're also us, for whom it's not so much about my enlightenment and my practices, but it's about yours. So I'm practicing so that you can wake up. And the wonderful thing that happens is the byproduct of that is it's good for me too. But I'm not focusing on me. I'm not doing it for me. I'm actually doing it for you. That's the attitude of the bodhisattva. And what helps the bodhisattva keep going, we have assists. And they've been kind of articulated, invented by people through the centuries. And we have our vows. And a vow is something, it's bigger than your particular concern. And it may even seem impossible. In fact, the bodhisattva vows are impossible. And we'll chant them at the end of this talk. We say, beings are numberless. I vow to save them or to awaken with them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So it's not, the bodhisattva vow right there, I think that to me, that's a spiritual intervention. And sometimes, I try to think my way out of things and it's just not working. And that to me is a sign, shift into a different domain. Don't try to think about it. Just open myself up to, that which is bigger than me. Whether that be a vow or, I'm really big into nature. But that's a spiritual intervention for me. When I go out and when I was depressed after the election and I went out into the woods and I was running around doing all that stuff, that's a spiritual intervention. It has the intention of waking up my energy, bringing in air. Bringing, allowing to be touched by the elements is enlivening to the energy of the body. And I think that's what turned the corner for those teachers, was they reconnected with their spiritual energy. And in fact, I brought a little piece here about that, because I think sometimes we think about spiritual means religious. And while I think it can, I think there's also what I would call a secular spirituality, which is where you're connecting with what has energy, what has meaning, aspiration, motivation. So, from my education days, I ran into a former client recently. She was the vice principal at a school in an economically depressed part of town, where the students had some of the lowest test scores in the district. And I had worked with her and the staff on and off over the years, helping them think through ways to support greater student success. So I ran into her at the hardware store. Orchard Supply. I love Orchard Supply. How are things going? I asked. And she said, we've just kept at it year after year. And you know what? We just surpassed, and she named one of the schools in the district that's like in a really rich neighborhood and a really high-achieving school. I'll call it, Palm Gardens. We just kept at it year after year. And you know what? We just surpassed Palm Gardens. Congratulations, I said. What do you think made the difference? How did this happen? And this is what she said. I went to my car and wrote it down after she said it. She said, we just maintained the mindset of believing in the capability of our student population, no matter who they were. And then she smiled and said, the truth of it is, essentially, I think this is spiritual work. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, the spiritual realm domain is where I turn to when I feel like what's needed is inspiration, aspiration. But then there's the heart. And sometimes that's where the obstruction is. Our heart, our hearts close to one another. And our defenses, we keep our defenses up. We suppress our emotions. And that's another way that we can be obstructed from really allowing and feeling the full potential of what we have to offer to each other as human beings. There's something so potent when the heart starts coming in. Maybe you've felt that before when you've been around other people. When we not only allow for the truth of our own feelings, but when we begin to empathize and feel the feelings of others and let them know that we feel their feelings, we understand their reality. And there's actually studies that I've been interested in that propose that the intimate connection between intellectual and emotional intelligence, that our minds are sharper and clearer and our higher thinking centers are activated and stimulated, the more our hearts are open and the more our emotions are allowed to exist as part of the fullness of who we are. And I mean all of our emotions. I mean, sometimes a good dose of releasing anger is the best thing that can happen in a stuck situation. Not always. And sometimes love, just being a fool and expressing your love, can just really turn it. And then there's the physical, the literal body realm. We feel we can get so physically disconnected from our own bodies, the truth of our own bodies, each other, and our feeling connected to the world. So I think sometimes that's where the obstruction is, and I think meditation is a really good place to work with that. Because here we are in our bodies, and we have the opportunity to become aware of them, to deepen our breath, to feel our butt on the cushion or our feet on the floor, to meditate on the physicality of where we are. I think I know a few weeks ago, Shoho asked people in the room to share, you know, what brings you here, and I hope it's okay if I share this. I'll find out. I'll say, somebody in the room, I won't say who, said, I come to this room because my body needs to be here. And so that's liberation in the body. You're not working with your thoughts. You're not aspiring to your vow. You're not working with your heart. You're just like, literally, my body needs to be here. The hug, you know. The hug. The power of the embrace. I have a friend coming over on Sunday, a Dharma sister who's suffering so much right now. And, you know, I know she's coming because she wants me to help her think through some of her, like, organizational stuff and everything. But I know that what I really want to do is just say, come here. Come here. You know? Just put my arms around her and just hold her. Let her cry. Let her sob. Let her rage. And she will do all those things, I betcha. As would I in her situation. So there's a term that comes up for me when I reflect on this. You know, we have these obstructions, and then there's the resources of these domains, and there's these different kind of liberative practices that we can do. And I think Zen has this beautiful, beautiful term that actually covers all of that. And Dogen said it in Guidelines for Practicing the Way. And he maybe others have, but that's where I first read it. And that's the term of arousing practice. And, you know, he said, arousing practice in the midst of delusion. You attain realization before you realize it. Right? So this term, arousing practice, He's telling us that, you know, we don't have to wait until things are perfect before we attain realization, but that this very place, opening the hand of thought, connecting with the vow, opening the heart, expressing the emotion, feeling the body, any way at all that we can arouse this practice, he's saying, if you can do that, and we do it in the midst of our delusion, that is realization. There's nowhere to go. It's not over there. It's that very act of arousing our practice. Remembering, oh, awakening is possible. And not thinking that it's going to come from outside of you. Later on in this teaching, he says, you know, this arousing practice, this is not made to happen by Buddha, but by your all-encompassing effort. So even Dogen, right, he said, there's not, Buddha doesn't make it happen. You make it happen. So it's about 7:18, and I want to make time for you to talk too. But before I do that, I want to read one more little thing here. I shared this with the people in Sesshin, and excuse me, I'm going to use a swear word in the Zendo. It's not a terrible one, but it is one. So I'm telling you, I'm giving you that advance warning. But I just love this. And to me, it's about this thing. It's about agency, which is one of my favorite subjects, which is where arousing practice comes in. And I say this with great compassion that you can't always do this. And there's plenty of times it's like, I ain't going to arouse my practice. Uh-uh. And I don't. And that's okay. But I'm talking about when you want to, or maybe you don't want to, but you're like, oh, all right, I'll give it a go. I'm just saying, if you're the only one who can do it. Sorry. So I think that's what he's writing about here. And it's actually at the end of the Mountains and Waters Sutra. It's an appendix to something from Gary Snyder. And he was writing about an ancient couple of ancestors, and one had been out meditating out in nature, and when he came back from his experience out in nature, he wrote a poem and he shared it with his teacher. And the poem is about his understanding. So the poem was, "The stream with its sounds is a long, broad tongue. The looming mountain is a wide awake body. Throughout the night, song after song, how can I speak at dawn?" I read that one more time, because this is the setup for something then. Gary says Dogen said, but I think Gary put in a little extra words down there, because I've never heard Dogen use that word. Okay, so here again, here's the poem from the student to the teacher after the student has been out meditating in nature. He says, "The stream with its sounds is a long, broad tongue. The looming mountain is a wide awake body. Throughout the night, song after song, how can I speak at dawn?" And he was approved by his teacher. Good job. So now, Gary says that Dogen said, two centuries later, "Sounds of stream and shapes of mountains. The sounds never stop and the shapes never cease. Was it Sue who woke, or was it the mountains and streams? Billions of beings see the morning star and all become Buddhas. If you, who are valley streams and looming mountains, can't throw some light on the nature of ridges and rivers, who the hell can?" Yes. So So I don't know, I kind of want to find, like, where is that Dogen thing and what did Dogen say? But, you know, I think that's pretty good because it sort of shocks us a little bit. Like, who do you think is going to do it? Who do you think is going to arouse practice? Your neighbor? The person on your phone? I mean, it's like, it's you. Oh, my goodness gracious. So, anybody want to add anything in? What do you find yourself? What's going through your head or your heart as you're sitting here listening to these words? Richard? Absolutely, wisdom mind. Absolutely.
So what practice during the day can I do to make this little shift over? I'm doing it, and I'm saying, let me see if I can, what can I do to go from this mind to this mind that goes up?
Yeah. Yeah.
There too.
Yeah. Okay. Great question.
Understanding why you're upset. And that it's a question. Mm-hmm. It's a question I just like to put out to say, well, okay, for each of us, what is the way during the day? Just like checking with your breath, or taking a step back, what's the way to say, oh, I'm kind of stuck in this, I'm out of my bear, I'm that driver, but do I have a mechanism for going? Wait a minute.
Yeah, so the question then, the practice question, is what can awaken my wisdom mind?
Absolutely.
And each person probably has a different answer, maybe at a different each day. You know, I think sometimes maybe when I really have been studying that my habits of mind and I recognize there's a real chronic pattern. Sometimes the wisdom mind is the same, reminding myself the same thing every day, right? Like coming up with something where I offer a different approach to the small mind. But sometimes it's not that specific, and it's more just maybe the general question of, you know, where is wisdom here? Where is wisdom mind here? Where is Buddha mind here? And I think that, you know, that a lot, there's so many different, I mean, we could spend a whole other talk, which we don't have time for, but that's a beautiful question, and I encourage us all to engage in that. And in the times when I've been in group situations where they did activate their wisdom, it was with questions like that. Well, okay, we got this and we got this, but like, what about that? You know, and calling in either a question about, well, what are we learning? You know, that can be a really great one. Okay, but what are we learning here? Or what are we curious about? You know, curiosity, inquiry, that's kind of in that general domain. And some people use the teachings to help access wisdom mind. I mean, you know, some people just, okay, I got to get out some Dharma and I'm going to start reading some Dharma or listening to some music or going outside and tapping in with the wisdom of the world. Yeah. But thank you for bringing in there is this, that's to me, that's the beauty of human potential, the richness of the resources that, you know, that same mind that can be so small and petty and vindictive and is the same mind or the same function, a human functioning that can create and that can solve and that can imagine and that can just do all the beautiful things that we love about the world, you know, in the human realm, we're created by that mind. And so remembering that. So thank you very much. Is there another? Yes.
I just had a powerful moment actually last night with exactly this. It was pretty transformative. And when I watched, it took a lot of courage to come to that moment. And I even brought a friend with me actually for energetic support. And what I noticed and was watching in myself was exactly what we're talking about. I kept quiet, first of all. I decided I was just going to keep quiet and listen. I was going to listen to myself, and I was going to listen to my mother, that was actually working with. And what I really noticed when I came away from the whole situation, when I wasn't actually physically in it, was really watching where I lose compassion and start to judge that part of myself. Mm-hmm. And that's where the disconnect happens. Mm-hmm. So I really worked hard at, and that's what I noticed, what I'm looking at now is that shifting that habit.
Beautiful.
To come back to that faster, to be more conscious faster.
Yes. Beautiful. Yeah. And our mothers can be really wonderful teachers for that. Bless their souls. Living and not living. Thank you. Yeah, and that what you're expressing is, you know, that's my understanding of that's arousing practice. You know, you're not just going along, you know, subject to that habit. You're actually working with it and bringing some intention in to doing your best to try to shift it in a way that's going to be something that will ease both of your suffering and hopefully bring some ease and joy and, you know, bringing forth that side.
So,
yeah, that's your intent, and it sounds like you're working on it. That's all we can do. And sometimes we succeed and sometimes we fail, but, you know, that's the nature of the bodhisattva path is we just keep doing it. We don't do, oh, I failed too many times, I guess I'm going to stop. We go, oh, well, when I can, you know, maybe I have to go hide for a while or chill or something. But at some point, you know, okay, all right. And, you know, and if you're working with, like, I don't know what your situation is with your mom, but I know when I was doing my mom practice, I didn't have any choice. I couldn't leave. So I had to keep working it. I had to keep practicing. I had to keep finding that mind. And, you know, it was a very powerful practice. So on that note, it's time to close, and I believe there is going to be tea. Are we still doing it outside, even though it's dark now? I guess, as long as it's not raining and cold.
Just on the porch.
On the porch. Okay, so we can kind of leave the door open, have a little inside-outside flow if we need to. Okay, well, thank you very much for your presence and your practice. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma beings are boundless, I vow to end them. The best way is unsurpassable.